did not see that coming.
I am Moana of Motu Nui. This is my canoe, and you will journey to different...
All right, get over it. We gotta move. And she's back.
I am Moana of Motu Nui.
It was Moana, right?
Yes, and you will restore the heart.
All right, I'm out. Oh, come on!
What is your problem? Are you afraid of it?
No, no. I'm not afraid. Stay out of it, or you're sleeping in my armpit.
That the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
No. Be afraid. Be very afraid.
There's nothing to fear except God. Whatever that means to you.
Do I look like someone who cares what God thinks?
You're listening to a podcast exploring faith and fear, what scares us and what saves us. This is The Fear of God. Hello, welcome back to your favorite podcast at the intersection of faith and fear, where every week we discuss what scares us in order to find what saves us. This is The Fear of God. Speaking to you right now is one of your hosts, Nathan Rouse, and typically with me is fellow host Reed Lackey. And guys, he was here a minute ago, but said he had to go kill an eel and bury its guts. I guess don't mess with Lackey when he is on the breakaway. In the meantime, allow me to welcome you listeners back into our big series for the year. What scares us / this time around, what saves us? But I'm getting a bit ahead of myself because here at the Fear of God, we explore. We don't explain, except for right now when I explain that you can listen to the Fear of God at your nearest podcast platform. You can watch the Fear of God on YouTube and you can browse the Fear of God on the web at thefearofgodpodcast.com, where you will find Reed. Hey, buddy. How's it going?
You're welcome.
Thank you. So, what?
That's all I'm going to say all episode. Because what can I say? Except you're welcome.
Oh, goodness gracious. This is going to get old quick. Reed.
Oh, hi, buddy.
This is a new era.
This is a strange era. Fear of God has seen many a strange day in
some 5 years. Things.
Yeah. You know, and you realize, I don't know if this is really registered for you yet. We are coming up on 5 years. Five years.
Clicked with me the other day.
Yeah. It's crazy. So,
you know, what's funny is I am at the beach right now. I've spent many a week at the beach. I'm just kidding. I'm gallivanting.
It's just a thing. I'm just a
Buffy. No, but I'm at the beach right now, where I've been for just 1 week. And the place we are at, not the house we're in, but the geography we're in, is a frequent summer destination spot of my extended families. And I still have a sense memory attached to you drop boxing the first few episodes, that August of 2016.
Wow.
And me being on the porch, this like screened in porch. It wasn't directly looking out at the beach. It's not that swanky. But it was a few streets removed from the beach, and just feeling that ocean breeze and just turning on the Fear of God episode one. It's pretty wild to ponder.
That's crazy. Yeah, it was August 23rd of 2016 is when our first episode dropped, and so we are coming up on 5 years. It's really crazy. But to get back to what we were saying, that the era we are in right now is one that we have really only ever dipped our toes in, just like for a couple of weeks at a time. Like the only times that I can think of that we've potentially covered stretches of non-horror material was kind of with A Very Burton Christmas, although some of that was still kind of macabre and
genre.
And
that, yeah.
Yeah. And then also with different seasons for Stephen King. Mm. That one was specifically non-horror material, but still King's the master of horror. And that was, sure, you know, a specific thing.
We were still tipping our Riri hat to the King.
That's true. That's indeed. but this next season is going to be really interesting because we're still obviously, you know, we're not changing the thesis statement of the show. Still examining what scares us in order to find what saves us, but focusing for a few months specifically on the what saves us end of that spectrum, and specifically examining some things that aren't exclusively horror, although we did receive a couple of horror submissions, and we received some things that could loosely count as such if they're not immediately qualified as such. But yeah, this is exciting. I'm really, really curious to see like just how these things kind of play out over the course of the next few months through the rest of this year. I'm eager, if you will.
Well, and that's a good segue, Riri, into a bit of business time, which is
a bit? Yeah.
So you didn't clue listeners in at the end of last week, and that's okay. It's okay. No shade here to the fact that we're going a bit in reverse here, which is you started What yes. Scares Us. I ended What Scares Us. I am starting What Saves Us with today's true. Entry, presumably meaning you will end What Saves Us. But in order to have What Saves Us exist whatsoever beyond you and I, we need people to submit. And, please, you know, we've gotten a few, but we want more. If you are listening to this episode right now, if you're driving, keep driving, get to your destination, get somewhere safe and park before you do this. But if you're not driving, you have no excuse.
Stop what you're doing.
Go to thefearofgodpodcast.com. Click on the banner at the top where it says What Saved Us, or however it's worded, and go submit your candidate for What Saves Us. A film, you know, we did cover The Witcher and What Scares Us. And
yeah, a TV show would I be feel fair
like
game.
I feel like that saved me. not speaking of Jennifer Vandenberg, but you could go do a TV show as long as it's digestible, to use a word Reed coined in his pitch for What Scares Us, digestible and accessible. If it's roughly in that 6 to 8 episode sort of run, we might consider that for a TV guidepost for What Saves Us. In a general sense, films. If you wanted a book, we consider just about anything digestible and accessible. And those of you who have been around long enough, you know, okay, movies are the easiest gateway to some of this stuff. But films that just fill you with hope, instill in you compassion, bolster you in love, those things, and they can be horror tinged. They can be animated features. You know, whatever most fills in that blank for you, submit that. And you know, there's a decent chance we will cover it on the show. I'm really excited. I'm a little apprehensive about today, but I am excited for today and what comes later. But yeah, so What Saves Us, and you know, I don't know if you have anything to add to What Saves Us or any other sort of bits of business.
No, I would just emphasize with you that we have received submissions, so we've received a decent handful right now, but in candor, we have not. Now, we're recording this a little early, but we have not yet received enough submissions to cover the entirety of the rest of the year, so we can't do this without you. I would just emphasize that as well. We've received a good probably half a dozen submissions right now, but we encourage you, please, if you did this already for What Scares Us, then you're going to do the exact same thing for What Saves Us. We really want to hear from you. Yep,
awesome. That's it. Well, that's business time.
That's some business time.
We now need to queue up our favorite crew of Islanders with
What You Watching,
What You Watching,
What You Reading,
What You Reading,
What You Listening To.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Island Crew, which feels like a particularly clever reference given the nature of the film we're watching today.
I thought that when you said that. I was like, oh,
yeah.
That's fun. That's fun.
Riri, you, all right. This is not, I'm asking you.
You're asking
me? I'm asking you. You sideswiped this last week.
Uh-oh. Okay.
But tell me about the Bluey experience.
Oh, man. Well, so as I mentioned last week, Vera's piece that she wrote for our Whatcha blog about it gave me a really good primer. My intention before that was basically just to go through the show. I mean, the episodes are only 7-8 minutes long, so it's really easy. They're all on Disney Plus. But what Vera's blog did was give me an opportunity to sort of hit the highlights and immediately sort of get acclimated. What I knew is that, as you called out last week, despite the fact that there is a pretty decent continuity to the show, that the episodes themselves don't really require that. You can kind of dive in anywhere. And so I took that note and just basically ran through. I forget now if it was like 10 or 12 episodes, but she had given kind of these are her favorites, from some from season one, some from season two. Now I should also say out the gate that I was already primed to love the show. When she had shared it with us on 47 Meters Down, I already knew, like, okay, this is going to be a show that is toned in a way that I'm probably going to be respond to. But here's what I was not ready for. First of all, was I was not ready for the emotional wallop that 7 minutes can lay on you from episode to episode. Now, that's not every episode. Some episodes are just cute, charming, sweet, endearing, all of those ranges. But there are a couple in there that I was not prepared. I'll call out specifically the one that really got me, and it is kind of more for moms, but the episode called Baby Race, I had to stop. It was like towards the end of the list that she had done, because I just basically went through her list, the season one episodes and the season two. And I was big smile on my face. I was charmed by what I was seeing. The characters are really accessible and really easy. Vera says in her piece that they're a very Australian show. And I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. That's, you know, just the little accent that they speak with is really cute and charming. And I swear Bluey's laugh just really gets me every single time. It's so, so delightful. But then when Baby Race comes, the premise of Baby Race, I don't want to steal Vera's thunder, but the premise of Baby Race is just the mom in this family unit. They're a family of, dogs, and the mom in this family is having some insecurity about the way that she's raising her child, because, oh, well, my child's not walking as fast as these other childs. And she sort of initiates Bluey into a bit of a baby race where it's just like, okay, who's going to walk first? Well, she's got to walk before the other mom's child walks. And I was so connecting with, like, oh my God, I can relate to that. And I thought it was going to be played for laughs, right? And I thought it was going to be played for just, like, you know, cutesy sort of fun charm. And I don't know if I should spoil this or not, but
do it. Go for it. It's 7 minutes.
So towards the end, so Bluey loses the baby race, and she is, very, like, the mom is kind of like, okay, whatever. And she's kind of trying to come to terms with it. But then a neighbor comes over towards the end of the episode and sits down with her, and the neighbor has another baby. And, you know, the neighbor's child, you know, is playing next to Bluey, and the neighbor mom leans over to her and she shows her a picture. And that's the moment that Bluey's mom realizes, like, oh my gosh, you have 8 children. Like, you've got all of these different
kids. And then the mom corrects herself, said, oh, 9.
You know, that's right. She's like,
she even gets the number wrong of her own children.
It's so funny. It's so funny. She's like, no, I've got 9. And then she says, yeah, and there's something that you really need to know. And so I was like, oh, okay, this is probably going to be sweet. And she looks at her and she says, you're doing really great.
That's great.
And I got hit with this wave of emotion. I just got hit with so much emotion. And that was that. Credits could have rolled. Credits could have rolled. But then there's another scene after that. I don't know how well you remember the episode.
Oh, yeah.
But the scene after that, because she's recounting, I don't think I said this part in the setup, she's recounting this story to Bluey and her sister.
Bingo.
And, yes. And she's recounting that story of when. And it ends with when Bluey took her first steps. And she said, like, oh, yeah, so you walked in the kitchen. You took your first steps in the kitchen. And what's really great is then it shows you the moment. And this is the kind of subtle, I'm not going to be too heavy-handed on it, that I think is part of the show's brilliance, is because she's walking. Bluey is kind of edges her way up to the kitchen counter. And then you see Bluey begin to sort of wander out from the counter and begin to take her first steps. And in the background, you're hearing the voiceover from the conversation they're still having while the memory is playing. But then what you see is just like, oh yeah, the I forget the exact lines, but it's just like, oh yeah, the kitchen's a weird place to have your first steps. They're like, oh yeah, that's a strange place to have the first steps in the kitchen. And right when she says that, it cuts to Bluey's point of view, looking up at the mom. And when Bluey's point, I'm getting choked up saying this. Bluey is looking up at her mom as Binka says, there must have just been something you wanted.
Yeah.
And Bluey is walking towards her mom. Even I like ugly cried. I was Oh my God. Like,
well, you should, watch it, watch this one first and then go read Vera's. Now you're a super smart person and you'll probably pick up on a lot of these layers without this help. But I had already seen a particular episode. Reading Vera's notes about it made me, oh my gosh, wow, there's more going on there. Then rewatching it, it'll mess you up.
Are you talking about Sleepy Time?
No, Sleepy Time's art.
Oh,
Sleepy Time is high art.
It really
is. 7 minutes. Referring to actually is similar, but a little more high concept, and it's called Flat Pack. But the loose concept, the loose concept is Bluey and Bingo are using the refuse from a big package where the parents have bought a piece of furniture. So the parents are putting together a piece of furniture on the porch. They're throwing pieces of the packaging out into the yard and the kids are playing with them. And what proceeds from there, I am not overstating, becomes a meditation on God and man. It is bonkers how high it reaches by the end of it. And you're like, oh my God.
Well, just about the moment that, like, what's funny is, like, in every episode I watch, like, just about the they have precision timing on when to end an episode, when to pull out of it. They don't lean too heavy-handed on something. It's just, it's got a really light touch. I think that's actually what Vera said on our episode when she talked about it. But it's just, it's a really, really charming show. The fact that it's only 7 minutes, I mean, like, gosh, you can plow through 7 or 8 of them before you.
What's so funny is, listeners won't know this, I've been like, I've tried to have a light touch with you. Like, I've tried to be like, okay, leave him alone. Partly because, you know, like, your child's a little older than the demographic target of but I knew, I was like, man, if Reed just kind of plugs in, but if I overplay my hand, he's going to be like, man, I'm going to be kind of cynical about it. Not because you're a cynic, but I just know how I am. But even before I knew you had finally dived in, I was like, how am I going to pitch this to Reed? I was like, I know, because it's like The Simpsons meets Mr. Rogers. And I was like, Reed will really click in on that. Because like that was how, because it really, I mean, from the animation style, it's very crisp. It's very clean.
Sure.
It's got a high sense of humor that's occasionally absurd. Yet it's enmeshed with this extreme level of heart. Anyway, that's not my whatcha. I doubt that was yours. I just kind of queued you up for that. But
mine can wait because I kind of I'm delighted to talk about.
Well, here's another one that I'm pretty sure you've seen. Reed, we need to spend a few quick minutes here talking about the MCU's latest friggin' insane explosion. Called Loki on Disney Plus.
Yes, we do. I will yield. Man, oh man. Like, this is your watch.
Yeah.
I'm just going to lead with saying, like, I love it. And the more I think about it, the more I love it. I have heard mixed reactions to it. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts on it.
Or the final.
To the whole and the final episode, but to the piece as a whole. But I love it. I responded so strongly to this. I'm very
well. I am not ambivalent at all on Loki. My feelings were quite positive. I know I come off as probably just the MCU apologist, and so, you know, I can recognize that any even sort of like, oh, well, of course Nathan's gonna like it. I do think because what we thought was so little stakes was riding on it, they kind of had some freedom to go a little bonkers, and they sort of ran with that. What I mean by that simply is, as opposed to WandaVision, which started high concept, reached for the stars, and kind of landed in formula, which is okay, but did that. And then you had Falcon Winter Soldier, which had a very specific edict, which is make Sam Cap, which is great and is a fantastic sort of feeding line into the next era for that character in the MCU. But you see the seams, like, okay, you guys are really shoving this through. It feels like where Loki lands reveals its significance.
Yeah.
But it really was just let Tom Hiddleston have fun in a bonkers world where we kind of can make up whatever we want as long as there's some inherent consistency to it. And now I don't think it's kind of the perfect show by any means. Like, there are times I'm like, okay, the scripting a little weird, but he's so charismatic. The introduction of the Sylvie counterpart Loki, the wrinkle of the multiple Lokis by the end that leads to a hell of a moment for Richard E. Grant.
Oh my gosh. So great. Glorious purpose. Lord have mercy.
It's amazing. That's
yes.
Like, I love that it's on Disney Plus. I almost hate that it's on Disney Plus because that show is cinematic by the end of it.
Oh, like, man, absolutely.
I would love to see this on a giant, giant screen.
No, I agree. And it would not surprise me for any of these series, although WandaVision probably more than the other shows has lent itself to like the TV format because that's what it's playing with. It's playing with TV conventions. But it would not surprise me if there was like a special event engagement, theatrical engagement of just like, hey, like if you one or 2 days only, or maybe for a weekend or something, you can go and see these, and maybe they're spaced out like a couple of episodes, small break, a couple of episodes, and like an all day thing. It would not surprise me if some like art house theater or something, if Disney tried to do something like that, but I don't know. We'll see.
Well, and just now you tell me, you and I haven't talked about it beyond an initial 2-word response via text from you, but like, what did you make of the finale? And I don't even mean like quality wise, but like, what did you think of the story beats? And did you kind of do you know anything about that character? What did you think of the finale?
So I should say I knew, okay, spoilers for Loki, everybody. I will say that I knew minimal about Kang. I know next to nothing, you know, and so when he showed up, I remembered that, you know, the actor whose name escapes me, Jonathan Majors, from Lovecraft Country, had been cast as Kang. So you had tipped me off to that not that long ago. I hadn't really seen it before, but when you told me that and then I see him show up, I'm like, oh, that must be Kang. That must be who that is. But I didn't know anything really about the character. What I responded to really strongly is when Kang begins to unpack the stakes for Loki and Sylvie.
Right.
And he begins to say like, yeah, you kill me and they all come running. Like the timeline starts branching and you know, and even again, spoiler alert, when Sylvie finally makes the decision she does and he's like, see you soon. I'm like, crap, you know?
Right.
And so like to that, I responded very strongly. I felt like the moments towards the end were just heartbreaking with Loki and Sylvie. To say devastating might be a bit hyperbolic, but like,
characters, it is.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, I was going to throw in there, I feel like the Loki series' version of WandaVision's What If Grief, If Not Love, Persevering script line is Hiddleston saying, you can't trust and I can't be trusted. And perhaps that is why this show in general works on a stronger scale than the previous two, is because that line itself is character. Like everything is character pushing forward that narrative. And so when you have a creative team and you have two performers, and I'll shout out Hiddleston specifically, but a performer who so well knows how to play the motivation the creators have given them, like it makes it something special. And there were moments where I was like, man, this is a wild show. Like early on when you're just like, man, this is shooting high. And I don't know because I've only watched it once, I don't know if the finale will bear up under repeat viewings because it literally is a monologue more or less.
For a good chunk of it. Yeah.
It is so well staged There were moments where I was like, you guys know he is monologuing and you know how to shoot this.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, you just felt, I don't know if you remember this, the way the camera pushes in real close and then mm-hmm. pulls way out all in the same shot, stuff sure. like that. Yeah. But anyway, it's kind of wild by the end of that finale to think, holy crap, things like What If, the upcoming animated right. series, suddenly isn't just a flight of fancy. Like they've. That,
right.
Which is wild.
That's the other thing is like, Loki set up the fact of like, What If might be the rendition. This is exactly what you just said, that it might be instead of just, oh, wouldn't this be cute if, right. You know, if I think it's T'Challa with Star-Lord, you know, like, uh-huh. wouldn't that be cute? It's like, no.
Tony and Killmonger.
Right. That it's like, yeah. oh yeah, they're showing you iterations yes. of that, yeah. that,
which
that
is awesome. Will,
yeah, ostensibly exist in this multiverse platform. One thing that I heard that I fundamentally disagree with is, I heard somebody say like, oh yeah, the big pivots at the end sacrificed the story that they were telling. The reason that I disagree with that is because the very fact that for the very first time, WandaVision didn't have an automatic season two, Falcon and Winter Soldier, they haven't confirmed a season two or whatever, but the fact that the stamp at the end of the credits yeah, of Loki yeah. says Loki will return in season two tells me their story's not done. Right. So, basically, we just got to see the first sort of installment of this, and now they're going to be progressing this to the next part of the story. And I will say, I don't know if you read this, so we're not having a conversation about Black Widow, but you and I have both seen Black Widow. And one thing that I heard, and this is where meta-knowledge can get kind of funky, and I can maybe understand where somebody would be like, oh, well, now that's just the MCU showing off, or that's just Kevin Feige's like just playing around at this point, is... there's a pivot. I'm not going to spoil everything about Black Widow, but at the end of Black Widow, you'll probably know what I'm referring to. There's a scene that I expected to see that doesn't happen at the end of Black Widow. Like there's a weird time jump where they set you up for a moment and then suddenly it shunts things to like mm-hmm. 2 weeks later. Yes. And I'm sitting there. Well, no, it's not post endgame. No, the I'm not talking.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm not. I'm okay. talking about before the credits start rolling.
Okay,
I'm talking
gotcha.
About so that I'm clearer about what I'm referring to. I'm referring to both of the scenes that Scarlett Johansson is in, where suddenly you see like people driving up to her, and then mm-hmm. we just flash mm-hmm. to 2 weeks later. And I was like, mm-hmm. did I miss something? Like, what's going on? And I read an article where the director and the people involved just kind of shrugged and said, like, yeah, we aren't allowed to know what happened there. And when I hear things like that now, knowing like what they pulled off with Endgame, I'm like, okay, they've got a plan. The Endgame clearly gave them a certain degree of confidence to say like, okay, we can layer these things out and we can right. take our time with them and we can explore things. And obviously certain things will be left a bit to chance, but all of that to say, so this installment of Loki, I'm just really excited to see where they take this big thing now. The ending before the credits rolled, like when Mobius reacted to him the way he
that
did,
sucked.
My jaw,
that hurt.
Yeah. Yeah, it did, but my jaw hit the floor. I was like, holy crap. Like he's shunted to another multiverse version of all of this. So Mobius doesn't know him. And
you know, this is not meant to be an MCU episode, but I mean, the seeds they planted in that 1 hour of episode or 45 minutes, whatever it is, I mean, when He Who Remains, who doesn't actually in the episode go by Kang, but yes, you are correct to potentially apply that there. Mm. He even says, he's like, multiversal war. I'm like, oh my God, that
yes.
sounds cool. That's
yes.
wild.
That's
and I
where
just,
we're headed.
I love the idea that, you know, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield were told, listen, guys, you just can't say a thing. You'd have to lie for a year and a half.
For a year and a half, yes.
you know, yeah. And they're like, yeah. it's going to make sense at some point. Just trust us.
God.
And they're like, yes, Mr. Feige, give me my paycheck.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, is it Feige or Feige? I always forget.
Feige.
It's Feige. Yeah. Okay. So apologies for that earlier. But
that's all right. Like, if he's listening, please come on the show.
Please. We'd like to talk to you for a minute.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But what's funny is like, I remember thinking, and this will probably be my last statement on it, is I remember thinking like, yeah, what are they going to do that's bigger than like Thanos in Endgame? Like what could they possibly drop? And then He Who Remains drops Multiversal War. I'm like, that's bigger.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay. That's like,
oh, y'all hear him?
Oh, did he say what I think he said? Oh my God. Because I remember seeing the trailer for Immortals and it's like
Eternals.
Sorry. Yep. And it's like, we have never gotten involved until now. And I'm like, why didn't you get involved in Endgame? I'm like, oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, this would probably be big enough that would make people pay attention to all this stuff. But it's just, I'm really excited. I love it. And I'm on board maybe I'm sacrificing a bit of my critical hat to be so, but I love it. I'm completely engaged and I'm thrilled. And I mean, at this point, they could release, a 4-episode, 30-minute TV show about Howard the Duck. And I'll be like, okay,
would actually do great for them.
Right. And I'm like, okay.
There's Howard becomes a running supporting cast member. A couple of years ago in an iteration of She-Hulk, when she was practicing law, I think it was She-Hulk.
Wow, that's funny.
He's a running guest in that book. Anyway, that has been another installment of
What You Watching, What You Reading, What You Listening To.
Hail the MCU. Yes, that too. Woo!
So, why don't you bring us into this?
I'm kidding. Okay. I'm kidding.
I have questions for you.
Okay.
About
well, then start there.
Being your submission. So, well, first of all, a bit of history. I'll lead with this. We both saw Moana, not together, but in the theater. We both saw it, when it came to theater. And my response to it was on the positive side of lukewarm. So my response to it was not overwhelming. I liked it. I genuinely liked it, had minimal criticisms, but I did have some criticisms, some things that I just felt like, oh, well, this just kind of felt, like it was a little easy for me or whatever. So didn't have like a really strong response to it. So one of the things that I would say, and I don't want to like by this question leap to what potentially would be a concluding statement to our episode, but just like, are you able to contextualize a bit without getting too into the depths right now of just like why you think you responded so much more positively, to it, which is not intended to be a confrontation question.
Yeah. I get it. Sure. And even to preamble that a little bit. So I kind of went with my heart on this one. Mm. And there are some strong contenders that honestly, I heavily pondered. One of which actually we may get to anyway, because someone has suggested that and I'm excited and gave me an excuse to not use it for my own.
I had that same experience with a different film.
Yes, you did. but others that I actually, believe it or not, actually pondered was Spider-Verse, Kubo.
Kubo.
Kubo is magnificent. I think a lot of this choice is rooted in for a movie not at all about me, but is my affection for it and my using it as the answer to the question, what saves me, is rooted in the me I am right now. And what it's funny, I kind of willed into being. It was not an active choice on mine and your radar, but it kind of became this subconscious rudder for me to having ended what scares us the way I did.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what that film Trust does to me to start what saves us with this and how what Moana does for me. And for me, if trust is about utilizing our language here, if trust is about what happens when the world scares your daughter, then Moana for me is about what happens when your daughter saves the world. Mm-hmm. Which is actually not at all intended as pressure for my children, despite the way that was phrased. And so it's really just, and maybe this will lead us into a That's So Right segment, but it's just, it is my kind of story for the me I am these days, in a twofold way, in both of them equally significant in my spirit and life. One of those ways is that it acknowledges our role and participation in redeeming the created world. Mm-hmm. And the second thing, and these two things don't have to entwine, it centers on a feminine character in the world's redeeming. And both of those are, excuse me, significant notes for me. And so that's kind of a loose answer to your question. And I'm kind of toggling in my head whether to keep talking or to force us into that's the right idea. So I'll lead with this. I'll come out of that answered question with this. So perhaps as preface to, or as scaffolding for the next 30, 40 minutes of conversation for you and I, a couple of other movies have done something similar to this. One of which is Whale Rider, which I mentioned a couple weeks ago or a couple months ago, whatever. And the other is Black Panther. But where I'm going with this is, I'm 41 right now. 24 years ago, I remember sitting in a class at our alma mater, a religion course, my freshman year, my first semester freshman year. And the professor whose name I was trying hard to remember, and dadgummit, it's one of those where you'd see it and be like, oh, that's it, dadgummit. It's
right,
like,
of course.
It's like Karen Wheeler. and I remember this professor saying a statement that I kind of scoffed at in the moment because I was a dumb kid. And let me rephrase that. I was presumptuous based on the way I'd experienced the culture I came up in church-wise. And he said, you can't understand scripture and Jesus without understanding the Mediterranean world of Jesus's time. Mm-hmm. And I really thought that was dumb. And it's funny what life and experience will do for us. Because these days, how I take that phrase to mean, another thing Moana does for me, is that you must reckon with the otherness of a culture not your own.
Yeah.
And that you can't, you can, and people do it, and they do it all the time, and they do it constantly, and they don't know that they do it, and they don't know that they do it all the time and constantly. But you can't read into scripture a Eurocentricity that does not exist in it. Mm. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah, it does.
So those are big pillars to sort of maybe support the weight of some of this, but at risk of diving past the reef too soon, or swimming past the reef too soon, let's do some that's so right, Reed. See, I'm it's so in my blood at this point.
I know.
It's like that's so right. It's like an oily saxophone player. So too elements of movies that aren't horror. That is so right.
That's so right.
All right, thank you. So yes, I have to say a huge thank you to Andrew Nelson, who just spontaneously gave us the gift that is our That Ain't Right jingle, which will make its return. It may not be heard for some time, depending on, you know, what we cover and everything, but it will make its return. I promise you, it is not a gone thing, but was also gracious enough to try his hand at this when we said we were going to be doing this segment and sort of taking it in this turn. So yeah, this is our first official. That's so right. That is so right.
It's so right. And I'll start, and we'll do three here, okay. unless we just get excited and run with it. I think maybe none of what I would call That's So Right and Moana are second to each other, or if they are, it's only by degrees. But I think if I were to make a list of the top three to one of what I'm staring at here, number three might be.
Well, lead with number one. You get the privilege of going first, so you get your pick of the top one.
Right. Yeah, it's very specific. It's Tomatoa. It's Jemaine Clement just jazz hands it up. It's so amazing. What a weird character. What an amazing performance. What a wacky song.
It's really strange.
It's a major earworm. And I love it. It's shiny.
That's awesome.
I mean, you know, yeah. So I would say, of That's So Right, Tomatoa would be in the mix for me.
All right.
As far as that goes. What about you?
So mine, I hope I'm not stealing another one of yours, but
please, no, it doesn't matter. Go ahead.
There are things about this, and this is where we kind of get to define That's So Right. Because there are things about this that, despite what I said earlier, and I will lead with this, that my experience of the film this time was relatively the same as it was the first time I experienced it. I'm a little bit more attuned to a couple of thematic things that I responded to more strongly. And that having been said, even though I would classify my response to this film as on the positive side of relatively neutral, there are moments that make me tear up. There are moments that I find lovely and beautiful that I'm a bit of a sucker, a bit of a sensitive guy, and I still get very moved by. But when I'm thinking about like what's so right about this film, I gotta pour some seed on the deck for old Hey Hey, and that bird
boat snack.
That bird is so right, Nathan. That bird is so right. They pull the coconut.
Oh, that's
off,
hysterical.
And then like. He registers that he's in the middle of the ocean and the scream, which that's Alan Tudyk. I'm sure you
yeah,
know.
Yeah.
You know,
like, yeah.
And, you know, that scream that he does that just silences the moment the coconut goes back.
Oh, yeah.
Head. Coconut goes off the head and it's like, oh, it's just, oh, man.
That was wonderful. Pretty good, actually.
Yeah. But I just, yeah. Hey, hey. And then Hey, hey has his moment at the end where he actually catches the heart of Tafiti. And, I think it's, yeah, he's just, he's pure delight every single time he's on screen. So for me,
well, and you know, well, I presume you caught too. Alan Tudyk also voices one of the like elders in the camp. Too.
Oh, I don't think I had I had registered that, but that's all. Oh, no,
there's a scene early on in the camp when Hey Hey is actually seated on a pile of hot coals.
Oh, that's
and
right.
There's yeah, the elder who's instructing or whatever it is he's saying there. That's Tudyk as well. And you know, we should upstream your that's so right. Oh my God, I can't even do it.
Your
that's so right to just be Alan Tudyk himself. You know, when it comes to he's amazing.
He's wonderful.
Literally, I read a number of interviews today about this film, and I love how almost every interview is like an all Polynesian cast except for Alan Tudyk. Like, it's just lovely. Like, he gets, you know, that kind of billing. It's like, okay, well, yes, it matters that we have an all Polynesian cast, but it's Alan Tudyk. You know, it's like, you gotta have him. You gotta have him. Great. He was, do you know the run he's had as far as the Disney movies go?
I'm not sure that I know everything he's been in.
So, and I probably may be shortchanging him here, but he's King Candy in Wreck-It Ralph.
I did remember
he
that. Yeah.
The Duke of Wesselton in Frozen.
Yes. I did
and
know
he
that.
Is the, funny converse of that, the weasel from Weasel Town in Zootopia.
I don't think I remembered that. I don't think I remembered him in Zootopia. Yeah. Oh, that's cool. That's really, really cool. But yeah, hey,
some,
hey.
Even some I'm bringing there. Hey, hey. That's, hey, that, hey. That scene when that chicken screams for like.
That's, it's amazing. Well, and then she puts him in the little like cubby that the boat has and he's just. Just walking back and forth, man.
When Maui finally enters the story and he's on the boat and he takes Hey Hey ostensibly to later eat him and he tries to give him the seed. Yeah, and he's pecking at the wrong spot and he kind of tilts his head back.
Tilts his head. Oh, it's wonderful. I love Hey Hey. All right, bring us home.
I mean, it's a scene. Like, if you were to say, what is the element of the film Moana that you would classify at the top of your list, it is the moment when Moana parts the waters effectively.
Oh, wow.
And
yeah, wow.
Te Ka, the fire demon, reveals itself to actually be Tafiti, the sort of spirit of creation.
Minus
and
her heart.
Yeah. And one, the lyricism of the song present there is insanely beautiful, but even just that imagery, that scene, that visual, aspect of the character Moana walking on the bottom of the ocean with just, you know, think like, if you haven't seen the movie, one, go do it. It's easily available and a lot of fun. But also just think that Prince of Egypt kind of view, but
oh, with, yeah,
you know, 2016 animation technology behind it. So what that scene literally is and what that scene represents, I think would be for me, the top of my That's So Right list. Yeah. That's wonderful. So I think that's wonderful. We'll come out of That's All Right, and then I'll go into a question for you that feels like it should have been there. So yes, take us out.
That's just so right.
That's awesome. Dude, we have theme songs.
It's crazy.
Speaking of music, Reed.
Yeah.
I got a question for you.
Oh, you got a question for me?
Do you have a favorite song from Moana?
Oh, yeah. How Far I'll Go. I don't know if that's the name of it, but yeah, it is. That song, here's where I'm a sucker. Okay. Is there
this feels like a running theme lately. Like, listen guys, some ad man took advantage of me recently. And, let me tell you what happened is, he was like, Reed, you buy this thing, you eat this thing, you watch this thing, you're going to be amazing. And I took his word for it.
Yes. And this happens to me a lot with music in general. It happens, less frequently, but also with, you know, just certain movie moments, as it were. But it is, I would say, reasonably easy for a lovely melody combined with some emotionally charged words to choke me up. And that doesn't mean I'm going to stand there and just weep. But it is, and if a song does that to me, it is, it's going to do that to me a lot. It's not like it'll just like catch me once or whatever, but pretty much every time I hear it, and it's difficult for me to hear How Far I'll Go without having that experience. I also, in fairness, until it just got played to death, I had a comparable experience with Let It Go. First couple of times I heard that.
Let It Go is powerful. It's a
very powerful song. Again, got played to oblivion, but no, How Far I'll Go, just that whole lilt, you know, there's a light in the sky that I see. Yeah. Oh my gosh. It's just
singing that to my kids in the pool today.
And no one knows how far I'll go. And it's just, it's really beautiful.
Well,
and so, I love that song.
And borrowing your and Vera's imagery of the playground from last week. The lyric to the song, if I go, there's just no telling how far I'll go.
Yeah.
That's powerful.
Yes. It's wonderful. And of course, combined narratively with what she's doing in the moment that song, really comes to its zenith. She's, you know, releasing the buried boats, and she is moving beyond the reef. And it's a combination of just, loveliness and energy and narrative power that I respond to very strongly. So that's my favorite. What about for you? Do you have a favorite song in this?
I mean, I really do, at risk of sounding like a Disney shill here. I do love, let me phrase that. Okay. Sounding like a Lin-Manuel shill here. I kind of love all of them, on certain levels. Shiny, of course, being kind of that novelty act, but I love, I don't have the track listing in front of me, but the village song at the top.
Away. That one? Is that the one?
Well, that's more the Song of the Ancestors, which is what kind of comes, but that gets a reprise a couple times. Right. That comes in when she does discover the boats and plays the drum and has that vision. It also reprises itself during the credits.
Right at the very end. Right.
No, what I'm thinking of specifically is, you can find happiness right where you are.
Oh,
it's the Moana growing up montage.
Okay. I gotcha. Yeah.
And so there's that one. I mean, I love it might be a How Far I'll Go reprise itself. I don't know how it's titled, but the boat scene with the grandma when she shows back up in her Jedi spirit form.
Can I tell you a funny story about that?
Please.
I do not know
why. That's what we're here for.
And he has largely phased himself out of this, but for reasons I still cannot explain, my son had a brief fascination with, without subtitles, watching films he was familiar with in the Spanish language. And don't understand like what was going on, but he was just fascinated by watching it in the Spanish language. And I remember one of the films that got that treatment was Moana. So when even it happened in the moment, all I could think of were the times my son was watching that and I would be just in the other room or adjacent and I would suddenly hear, "Yo soy Moana!" And I was like, what is, what?
Oh my gosh.
So even when I was watching that scene this time, I can't see her stand on the end of the boat without the, "Yo soy Moana!"
That's
like, oh,
that's God. Amazing.
So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that yeah, cool. That's great. That's great. Well, I will try to find it and post to the socials when we release this episode. My now almost 5-year-old, circa 2017, 18 or so, when this was hitting home viewing. Do you remember this? Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
I do remember. Yeah.
I got a video of her because she got that song. She used to just like have these moments where she
gave her life.
She got caught up in the spirit. And I got a video of her in the culminating moment of I Am Moana, just arms flailed, just it's mouth so to delightful. The sky. It is. It's goodness wonderful. Personified. Awesome. And any, you don't have to, but did you have any questions for, other than Nathan? Why?
no. I mean, I am curious. So I will say this, and this maybe leads to a question, maybe just sort of, gets the brain bubbling a little bit, but, I want to explain a little bit about so my critiques, just in case we're going into this, I have no critiques thematically, at least none that I can discern at the moment. My critiques are all narratively. Like, I get frustrated a little bit sometimes. Maui has this big declarative exit after his hook gets smashed. And, I get slightly frustrated by not having any hinge point for why he just decided not to do that and come back. And it's good that he comes back and I'm glad he's back, but it's just sort of like, okay, he's out and now he's back. And so any sort of quibbles that I would make with the show are all relative to that kind of superficial sort of mechanics, to where I'm just like, oh, okay, well, that's just sort of an element of convenience. I don't have any, again, that I can discern any quibbles with what the show is trying to express, what the movie is trying to express, or what it's exploring. I find that all really, really lovely. I love the opening scene. It's another one that kind of gets me a little emotional and teary, just because of how achingly gentle it is when the ocean is playing with mm-hmm. young baby mm-hmm. Moana, and like she can barely toddle into it. And it is this, you know, the ocean, if you haven't seen this film at all, the ocean is a character. And so like the ocean like hooks its sort of figurehead around to her and then just like kisses her hair and, you know, twirls
her hair up a little bit.
Yeah. And I found that so lovely. And then while she's standing there, then suddenly the heart of Tefiti just floats mm-hmm. towards her. And when I first saw the film, I didn't recognize or appreciate, you know, precisely what was happening. But now sort of a second viewing, knowing exactly where the film is going, I found that remarkably lovely. Just this invitation, to this, still a toddler, you know, essentially a little older than a baby, this invitation to the heart of everything. And and I thought that was really lovely. Still find that really lovely. I think sometimes for me, I struggle a little bit with the Maui character. I love Dwayne Johnson. I think sure. he does great. Maui as a character is fun, and his moments where he's being funny are really great. But I think there's some things, and maybe this would lead to a little bit of a question, is he steals the heart of Tefiti, and basically, though he did not intend to do this, ruins everything. He just, you know, yeah. You know, he's just like, his failure is the inciting incident for this film. And, as a character, I couldn't quite get a grasp on whether he was telling the truth about his benevolent intentions. Like, oh, I just wanted to give, you know, the ability to all this life-giving ability to the people. I just wanted to give it all to human beings. And I don't know if part of my difficulty in connecting to the film is rooted in my difficulty in understanding the Maui character, because Moana, I am all in on. She feels, from the moment that the ocean dances with her when she was a toddler, she feels the spirit of beyond the reef and everything that is beyond the world that she knows. And in such, you know, feels a boldness and there's a real loveliness to her thrust to try to redeem this and to restore what's been lost about it. But I think some of what I'm struggling with is a little bit of the Maui character. So I guess the question that I would put to that is, how do you feel about Maui? And yeah, like, what do you think about that?
I was trying to come up with a song lyric, but I couldn't in the moment. I actually, while I don't share the strength of your critique, I don't know if you know this, or rather I'll lend a little bit of credence with your probing there, to your probing there, because initially the film, and it's probably through maybe this is me conjecturing a number here, 50% of its life cycle, was a film about Maui.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Okay.
Because, and this may be a thing you don't know, I don't know, but Maui, the demigod, is a mythic figure in Polynesian culture.
I didn't know that. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And so a turn sort of happens in the gestation of the film over the course of 5 years or so, because interestingly, Roger Clemens, I bet that's wrong. I'm thinking of the MLB pitcher from the 80s, Roger Clemens. Dadgummit, who are the directors? It is Clements and somebody. Directed by Ron Clements. I wasn't too far off there. Okay. Ron Clements and John Musker are the primary credited directors. Well, this is in Lasseter's era. They basically said, yeah, because Disney has a history of at least accusation of cultural appropriation or insensitivity, when those two directors I just named and now dropped IMDb, went to pitch the idea of this film to Lasseter, he basically said, well, you have to get it right. And so it began this 5-year kind of journey, and, you know, lots of vetting over pretty much every piece of the production, from a given lyric to a particular interpretation of a word. You know, they had basically a brain trust, and they did call it something trust. Maybe, I don't remember exactly what. Maybe the Moana trust. I don't remember. But this group of Polynesian historians and kind of, you know, sociological figures to help design the world and make it as authentic as possible. And so, long-winded way of simply saying, you may inadvertently be scratching it, you know, okay, I think originally there was meant to be something else here.
Oh, okay.
For the character Maui. And once they pivoted to center it on the character Moana, they then had to sort of pivot the role of the character Maui, you know.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
I mean, I remember specifically, and you just sort of alluded to it, the return there. I don't know. I mean, it's the old Han Solo moment on a certain level, but, you know, just kind of, yeah, I don't have a ton of narrative defense beyond just, oh, well. Eh.
Yes, sure. No, and I get it. I think what I'll lead with something that I genuinely enjoy about his story. Again, all applause to Dwayne Johnson. Dwayne Johnson's wonderful. Nothing about my quibbles with the character have anything to do with the vocal performance. But I do really enjoy it's a bit slight, but I enjoy when Tafiti is restored at the end and she looks at him right before she gives the hook and sort of extracts the, hey, you know, like, you know, you screwed up, right? Like,
right.
You know, and, And I do kind of like that because I think it's interesting to have a character who is clearly so, I mean, his song is You're Welcome. Clearly the ego on this character is enormous. And so to have that character be somewhat humbled in that way is interesting in and of itself. There are some parts of it that I'm just kind of like, wait, what? Because, and I do kind of like the turn here when Moana is pitched on the journey. Maui is an integral part of it. And then ultimately, while I so love where they land with it, Maui is largely a tangential figure in the heart of this journey. The ocean chose Moana.
Right.
And true, Maui maybe needed to sort of guide some things along the way. Like, you know, getting his hook back was more a favor to him than it was to her. Sure. Really didn't hold any, you know, like if she... I'm struggling in the moment to remember how integral he was in the finding of the place where Te Fiti was supposed to be. But that, you know, other than those sort of like logistical things, this is really Moana's story, which again, I love that, but I feel like the movie kind of points up to like, hey, you got to find Maui. Okay. So like Maui has to be the thing. And then he winds up feeling a bit more,
a guy.
Yeah, I don't want to be too reductive to him to call him that, but yeah, that's, so to get back into some of the things that I really respond to strongly and really, enjoy about this, you said something earlier, and this is becoming a bigger deal to me, but I don't want to, make your What Saves Us submission about me. So I'll just sort of hit this and then it's in as much affirmation towards what you were saying as it is an expression of me, on my own. Our role in participating in the redeeming of creation. That is a subject that is largely becoming of growing interest and importance to me. And some people might hear that and say like, oh, no, that's the role of Christ. Like, especially Christians might hear that and be like, no, that's Christ, like period, end of story. And okay, if we're going to have a version of that conversation, I'm not really going to argue very much with that because of the sanctity with which I hold Christ. But I do feel like it is becoming more and more clear to me that something in all of scripture, all of history, I think there's a reason why when Christ came, he then left and left it to us and said like, okay, now, go and do. As you've seen me do. And I feel like that's valuable. And I feel like that's, I pivoted away from it. I feel like that's vital. I feel like it's crucial that we understand that we have participation to play in this. And I love that the film kind of, in the blight that is hitting the island to where the fish have all gone, the crops are all dying, the coconuts are withering, the fruit is just decaying on the vine. That moving beyond what they know into what they don't know, is a big part of the journey for redeeming this aspect of creation. Again, I find that lovely and I respond very strongly to it. I apologize that I don't have a question to prompt, but yeah.
No apologies necessary. Well, I think, you know, we're kind of finding our way into this conversation, which is totally appropriate. This is a new era in the fear of God and for us as we navigate these waters.
Yes.
You're trying to measure the stars, Reed, not give them a high five.
Always my failure.
You made a comment a minute ago that some might say, and I understand why you would do that, and I often will do that as well, you know, well, that's the work of Christ. And this is my takeaway from Moana. You may not share this, or maybe I'm suggesting it's more radical than perhaps it is. But to pivot the words of the film for my own purposes here, you know, the Christ isn't out there at all. Mm. It's inside me. It's like the tide falling and rising. Like this, when you say dismissively to the theoretical of A, well, that's the work of Christ. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let us work. Mm-hmm. And that to me, so the reason I keep coming back to this notion across multiple conversations of otherness and even a feminine centered story is in part as the father of daughters, but is also coming to terms with the recognition that an othered perspective is necessary for me to use the lens to comprehend how I contribute to the tearing down of creation, how I inadvertently contribute to the tearing down of not me's in the world. Does this make sense at all? Like, in other words,
I'm following so far. Yeah.
These cultural lenses that I don't know about you, though I imagine I would wager a guess it is so. More or less, if you grew up in the American church, the characters in this film was the mission field. They were others to be saved, not participants in our saving. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yes.
And yet,
understood. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And yet, that's kind of the truth at the end of the day, which is, you know, this otherness isn't a thing to be stomped or squashed. It is a thing to be loved, revered, held up, encouraged, bolstered, and joined.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's really just a powerful view to me that, you know, I mean, it's putting a real fine point on it to call Moana a Christ figure, but I think in many ways that's the case. And, or at least she actually serves as a good template for what I'm trying to say, which is she partners with the God figure to redeem the world, right? Like she joins that story. She joins that mission, and becomes an agent of creation's reconciliation.
Right. Right.
You know, another sort of thematic idea that really kind of rings out to me, and I actually brushed up against some of this idea last week on Stranger Things in unpacking Hopper's letter to Eleven, and it's watching Moana, the story, the film, and the dad's insistence on I actually think there's a really lovely picture of health in a general sense in the village. And there's nothing antagonistic or sort of sinister about any sort of attempts to curtail Moana's adventurousness. But at the same time, if we take the story on its face, it is the father's fear that hampers and hinders and threatens to prohibit redemption itself from occurring, right?
Right.
And so I really wrestle with this as a person who, sad some days, awesome others, is basically the dad figure in a story like this, as I wrestle through how the older generation, our fears limit the capacity of the younger generation's possibilities, right? Like, and so what they have to do instead is sort of defy in the name of health and goodness on a certain level.
Right.
If that makes any sense. And I think, I don't know. Any responses to that?
Yes. So, you talk about the picture of health. So here's what I'm wrestling with in the real is this notion of, and I'll tell you exactly what pinged for me is the idea of external versus internal. And I'm going to make a, here's the part of the show where Reed makes a bold statement. Okay. So,
we need a song for that.
We do. But for me, it's if we state a thing, we too frequently will have a tendency to make exclusionary statements. I do it. I feel like a multitude of other people do it. Like there's a risk I have in expressing Christ as exclusively an external being, that I am removing the inner workings and me and my embodiment of the hands and feet as such.
Sure.
Likewise, I feel like the reverse is also a potentially exclusionary statement, that if I revoke or ignore the potential for external factors, then I'm missing a huge chunk of the equation. And that's what it comes down to for me in terms of this concept of partnership. There is something that is not me, that mm-hmm. is flowing, pulling, pushing, drawing, all of that. And that I would speak of in external terms. And maybe those are the terms about which members of the Christian faith might feel more comfortable talking about. God as out there, Christ as out there, all of these things as out there. And then there's other traditions and other expressions, other philosophies that are significantly more comfortable talking about the what is going on the inside, which I also believe is the work of Christ. I also believe that something, the scriptures say that he has set eternity in the hearts of man. So there is an endless, or to quote Bob Dylan on this, I contain multitudes. He was not the first person to say that, but you know, like this idea of there's a vast amount of things inside of each of us, that has tremendous influential power, tremendous affecting power. And I think when we're talking about this notion of, and I'm going to mirror it to what you, or I'm going to try, hopefully not too clunky, to link it to what you said about the father and his fear sure. being the inhibitor, is I think when you begin to push out possibilities and probabilities on one side of that discussion or another, then fundamentally you have it's a literal like divorce, like you've divorced a huge element of the equation from yourself. And I think we do that out of fear. I think a lot of times our unwillingness or our inability to wrestle with things that are beyond the scope of our conclusions really comes down to fear. It really comes down to, well, if I don't, you know, if I admit this possibility, then I don't know where that will take me. And I think that for myself, let me get out of the headspace and get down, hopefully a little bit more practically speaking, is when I think of the redemption of creation and I think of the participation that I play, there's two things that I think are, extremes of this that are bad examples. Extreme number one is, well, I have no role to play in that. I have nothing to do with that. That's just the work of Christ. And so, you know, Christ will do it or he won't. And, you know, call that deterministic, call that whatever, but it's just like, we are just merely passing along, this journey, almost like we are, the script has already been written and we're just sort of puzzle pieces that are getting moved around the board. So that's one extreme. The other extreme, comes specifically from my culture where I can remember not that long ago. Well, I won't put a timetable on it. At some point, I rejected the notion that a person's salvation depended upon whether or not I shared the gospel with them. Just again, I'm talking, sure. you know, cultural yeah. things that like that a person, whether or not a person got right with God depended on whether or not I shared the gospel with them. And oh man, I should, because you've probably sat under the sermons where they would sit there and they would say like, oh man, if you didn't share it with Jesus and then they died in a car wreck and then they're, you know, they could be in hell because you didn't do blah, blah, blah. And I've come to a place to where I vehemently reject that notion. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest reasons of that is because of kind of what I'm scratching at right here. Wait a second. There is something beyond me that is at work here. And to say it is all resting on me is vanity. To say that it is all resting upon my shoulders is ego and it is hubris. It is Maui clutching the heart of Tefiti and saying like, oh, I'm going to give this life to them. You know, like it's saying like, oh, I'm going to make this choice. And I think that thoughts like that will more often lead to destructive tendencies and a desperate need for control than it will any sort of redemptive process or redemptive work. At the same time, I think when we lean too heavily on the fact of like, oh, well, that's what God does. I also get frustrated when people will sometimes say, or like there'll be a decision and be like, that was just all God. That was just all God. And I'm like, oh, okay. I receive the humility with which you're trying to express that. But for me, I'm just like, you've made choices. You've made sure. choices that have positioned yourself to a certain place. And I think part of where I'm at right now and part of what I really enjoy about an exploration like what Moana is working with is I think I'm sitting in a place where I am really embracing of that participation. There's something out there that I can't control and that is constantly flowing, like a river, like an ocean, whatever visual metaphor you want to attach to it. I believe that's God, Christ, the Holy Spirit, that that are flowing and moving constantly, pushing me, drawing me, doing all those things. I also believe there is a work happening within me, rooted in my choices, rooting in my my uniqueness as a person. And all of those things are at work participating together. And I can, again, choose to participate in that. And if I do so, then maybe wonderful and good things will come of that. If I don't, I think it'll be to my own detriment and maybe to the detriment of the people on, you know, like the blight of the island, if it will. But I think that our own fear, again, I'll say this and then I'll shut up about it. Our own fear will sometimes lead us to say, whichever version of that gives us the most control, that's what we want. So that's where we'll land. If we are upended by any concept beyond an external God, then we will reject our role in participation in the redeeming of creation. If we are uncomfortable with the powers and principalities that have leveraged an external force for their own ends and therefore, you know, do away with that, I think, again, we are putting ourselves into something that we can more easily control. And I think our fear inhibits us because we want what we control. When the Father sees the blight of the land, he's like, we'll plant new fields. We'll do this. Like, it's all things that he can do in his purview. And I'm just going to do this. And one of the things I love, I'll use the language of Moana. Moana's like, we got to go out there. Like,
right. Like, right.
We've got to go out there and we've got to. And there is
we were voyagers.
And there's something we have got to discover, uncover, engage with that is out there that will, you know, fit this puzzle. Fit, you know, we can't just solve it on our own. I'm at the risk of rambling right now, but hopefully I've made enough sense to kind of understand where I'm coming from. You can be as honest.
You're good. I mean, it's funny. It correct me if I'm wrong, but it felt like you were establishing kind of the dichotomy between, you know, if all there is God outside versus if all there is God inside, you know,
yes.
And kind of how we sort of, you know, wrestle that down. And I think for me, a lot of times there's sobriety in just recognizing either path is just too big.
Yeah, I get that. Yeah, of course.
You know, and it's like because you make a good statement or a sound critique of the, well, if that person didn't hear the gospel from you, they are in hell now. It's like, well, okay, that's an insanely unfair sort of amount of pressure to burden an individual with. And yet at the same time, I would say, well, if I carry Christ with me into all places, by virtue of, like Moana, knowing the aspects of me, i.e. a sort of holistic view of self that can somehow reflect a Christ-likeness, well, then perhaps a salvific experience can be had by people in my orbit. Mm-hmm. And from that vantage point, it doesn't feel like lip service to to participate on a particular way.
Right.
You know, I think I read a brief interview with Lin-Manuel about the film, and there was one quote that really kind of fascinated me. And the question asked to him was, how did revisiting your own teenage sense of yearning for something more help you get into Moana's head when writing How Far I'll Go? And he said, where she and I met was having a calling, not necessarily even understanding the calling, but knowing that it's there. I knew I wanted a life in some creative endeavor for as long as I can remember. For me, I think the song took the final turn it needed when I realized it's not a song about a young woman who hates where she is and needs to get out. It's a song about a woman who loves where she lives and her family and her culture and still has this feeling. Mm. So what do you do with it? And that is kind of the eternal question for me. And it's a question I kind of hate. It's like, I have this station and place and family that I love.
Yeah.
I remember, it's funny, I don't know if you've ever had an experience like this. A couple years ago, I just finished some heavy, hard book.
You?
And yeah. And I remember saying this thing to my wife, because I felt like I there are times, and it's, you know, maybe it's the state of my life currently in terms of the way my time is occupied or you know, kind of overtaken even, where I just feel like it's like there's just nothing left to go in.
Yeah.
Like I just can't hold anything else, which isn't a statement of desperation. It's more just a statement of fact. Like, I'm full.
Yeah.
I don't. And it was interesting, because I was sharing with my wife. I was like, what makes me angry in an appropriate way? Is there are moments where, I mean, damn, to use the movie's metaphor, like, I have everything. There's the reef. I need to get past that. I need to take what I have, which is good and great and beautiful and lovely, and somehow translate that into embodying a calling. I don't know what that totally means. Does that make sense at all?
Yes.
And it was like equally a lovely and frustrating experience and statement for me to just be like, yeah, I can read more books about my wife was telling me about a podcast she listened to right now about a book. She's like, oh, you'd love the book. I mean, you'd hate the book, but you'd love the book. I'm like, yeah, that sounds right. Yeah.
Sure.
But because of that kind of thing, it's like, I know what it's going to fill me with and what it's going to sort of stir in me. And I don't know where to channel that agitation, you know?
Yeah. Okay.
As opposed, and ultimately it's like, yeah, I want to be a caretaker, a participant. If you're taking the metaphor of getting full up on the knowledge of the world and somehow turning that knowledge into betterment of it, it is saying, I've crossed the horizon and found you. I know your name.
Yeah.
This effed up scenario, this effed up people, these jacked up powers and principalities have stolen the heart from inside you.
Yeah.
But this is not who you are.
Right. Right.
And like, yeah, I am Moana, Reed.
Yes, I'm on.
That's a perfect button.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And, I feel like in many ways that is, it is an invitation to each and every one of us of just like, you know, okay, this is, I love the way you put that. It's like, I have everything I need, but I still feel this calling and there's something beyond the reef. And, it's lovely. I could go on for another, hour or so, but, I will yield. You want to go to, I think we need like a new sort of metric rating system for this. So
well, substance can still work. Is there another?
I know something else that
we can just rank substance, I guess. We'll
okay.
In the interim, we'll figure out something else if there.
Okay. Yeah. So we'll still get the. So what would you rate it on the God meter? This film that is
me. Normally, I mean, this is my selection. I'm giving it a 10.
You're giving it a 10. All right. I feel like I said, what is baked into this story's exploration, I do respond to really strongly. The narrative and the way it does it, is where any of my quibbles lie. So. I'm going to see your 10 and I'm going to make mine an 8. And that means that if we're just doing it that way, that means that, you know, on the aug meter, fog meter, you know, we seriously, so next time,
I'm like, what?
Yeah. Next time when we're going to really pivot away from the measurements, we should have a conversation about it beforehand.
Sure.
So that we know exactly what we're doing. But for this one, we'll just go ahead and say we give it a 9 out of 10. I think it's, go ahead.
No, I'm just, there's no easy button for me here. You know, I think I reference this on our minisode, you know, borrowing the language of Barbara Brown Taylor's sort of experience of what's saving you now. You know, I actually don't disagree with you that not every piece fits the puzzle perfectly in the film, but the picture painted of a beautiful culture, beautifully visualized, that encourages and emboldens us towards and declares us participants in a good work flowering around us and beyond us is a thing that is saving me now. And it doesn't help that it's got the music of Lin-Manuel Miranda to go along with it.
Yeah, that doesn't hurt. Yeah, of course. I would recommend the film, even though what I've said about some of the narrative pieces don't quite work for me, but I would strongly recommend the film. And I feel like for me, this film and what we've discussed in it is an important reminder to me that I am not incidental, nor am I ultimate. And I'm not inconsequential, but at the same time, it's not all riding on me. And I think that is a healthy tension to keep in mind. I am here on purpose. That does not translate to it's all on my shoulders, and you know, there's no other thing but what I choose to do, because I feel like that's narcissism. I feel like that's ego. But I think that's a healthy tension to live in, and maybe that's the dance that, you know, that's how we find out who we are. And that's how we can potentially restore the heart of things that have been missing that needed us to get there. So, yeah.
I like it. I recommend Moana without reservation.
Yeah, there it is. There it is. Okay, so obviously the show is going to be changing quite a bit over the course of these next few months.
In ways we didn't even think ahead on.
Exactly, yes. Next time, okay, so note to self, like pick a new meter, you know, like, but I will say, so we've mentioned this earlier in this show. We're recording this due to some traveling plans and stuff like that. We're recording this rather early in the game. So at this moment, I'm just going to go ahead and say we do not know yet what we are covering because we not know what we're covering next. Yes, we have some things in the pipeline, but haven't really played that out yet. So pay attention to social media. And I will make another pitch that if you have not yet submitted, maybe by the time this airs, we will be swimming in submissions. But in case we're not, please, if you have not yet submitted, go to fearofgodpodcast.com, click on the banner on the top, share your story with us about what saves you. And as we've explored here, that could mean any variety of things. You know, participate with us, partner with us, and share your story. And we
maybe an episode of Bluey.
Oh, that would be great.
Man, that'd be a really short podcast.
I was just going to say, like, that'd be...
But probably not. We'd be like crying and...
Oh, of course. Yeah. We'd have to
bum shuffling.
Four or five episodes of Bluey put together on one little discussion.
That's our TV guidepost. Ooh.
Ooh. Ooh.
We're not setting that aside just yet, because we may have just inadvertently found something gold.
That is great. That is great. So yes, stay tuned to our social media feed to see where we're going next. Submit your What Saves Us if you haven't already. Nathan, thank you very much. It was refreshing to get to reflect on these things again and to get to see Moana again and get a little teary in the moments that still make me teary. Thank you as always for these conversations. And as we say on every episode, the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom and not the end of the conversation. In that spirit, we encourage you to fear nothing else and be on your way rejoicing. We will see you next time, everybody.
See you guys.
The fear of God is the beginning of wisdom, but not the end of the conversation. And you can continue the conversation in a variety of ways. You can start by visiting thefearofgodpodcast.com for all the latest news and episodes, or for merchandise and to contact us directly. You can follow us on Twitter at The Fear of God, on Instagram at Fear of God Podcast, or join the Facebook Fear of God discussion group. Special thanks to Jacob Hunt of JacobHuntComics.com for our artwork, to Lee Wright, who helped me, Reed Lackey, write our theme music, and to Tyler Smith at MoreThanOneLesson.com for making our show possible. Lastly, be sure to subscribe to us on your podcast platform of choice, and if you listen to us through iTunes, we would greatly appreciate a rating and a review. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next week.